Hey there, and welcome to Grapes and Grain Podcast. I'm Teenie.
And I'm Laura, and this podcast is about our favorite thing in the whole world,
alcoholic beverages. So today we're going to talk about Australia, the land of the wild and crazy creatures and a never-ending source of amazing quirky news. The Australians are also notorious booze hounds, which makes them sound a lot like my people.
Totally agree. I've loved every Australian person I've met out in the wild, and I'm so excited for the opportunity to meet many more while I live there for the next 6 to 7 months.
Yes, we are doing this episode in honor of Laura's transition to moving to Australia.
Yeah, not a forever move, just a immersion experience, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been doing a lot of research about the wine scene in Australia to prepare before I go. Boozy places to visit, sights to drink. So,
of course,
we put together an episode about an outback drinking adventure. So I'm really excited about this one specifically because neither one of us knows what the other person has chose to highlight and talk about.
That's so true. And neither of us has really ever experienced the Australasian, you know, that's what they call that. Mm-hmm. All the groups of islands down there.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Neither of us have ever actually been there and experienced it. So this is going to be really aspirational, really exciting.
Yeah. And of course, you're going to come visit me out there, right? So we can do some of this stuff together.
Oh my God. After doing all this research, I cannot wait to come visit you. Yeah. Oh my God.
Well, did you bring an Australian beer that you researched? Tell me, Teenie, what you drinking?
Actually, what I'm drinking is New Zealand beer.
Oh, yeah.
So this is from Moa Brewing, and the brewery is named for the ancient dinosaur that was from New Zealand.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
I love it. I love dinosaurs.
Yeah. So, New Zealand, we're going to highlight a little bit in this episode, but I thought what better way to bring it into our conversation than to get the beer. Also, I will tell you this. I went to Total Wine, which I consider like the foremost source of diverse beer. Mm. The Australian and New Zealand section is tiny. It's this beer, which this is their Imperial Stout aged in Pinot Noir barrels. So we'll get to some tasting notes in just a minute. But it's this, which I bought in a 4-pack. It's two different kinds of Foster's, which is not even made in Australia.
And yes,
coincidentally, it's made in Fort Worth, Texas, where we're from.
Yeah.
All of the Foster's that you buy anywhere in the world is made in our backyard.
No way.
This is true. Yeah. And they had one other beer. It was called Cooper's. Apparently, this is like the iconic Australian brewery, but I misinterpreted some information before I went to the store and I thought it was owned by a bigger company.
Oh.
Turns out it's the oldest and largest, or it's definitely the largest. It's the largest independently owned brewery in Australia. So, but I decided to go with the Imperial Stout anyway because I had some bad information and because I've been drinking a lot of pale ales as we've been doing this. This is an Imperial Stout aged
variety
in Pinot Noir barrels. As you can tell, Laura, and for our listeners at home, you cannot see through this. This is an opaque, dark, deeply chocolatey color beer.
When you poured it out of the bottle, first of all, the label is black. The bottle, I guess, is dark green, and here it looks almost black. And then when you started pouring that out, me and Ben were like, holy frijoles, that is one dark beer.
It is. And if you smell it, it smells like wood.
Oh,
smells like funky wood,
does.
Sour wood.
Wow,
that is from its aging in Pinot Noir barrels. And in fact, I couldn't find much information on this beer. I couldn't find it on the Moa website, but the box of it.
There's a lot of awards on the label, too.
Yeah, it's award-winning, but the box had like this boxer on it, like an old-school illustration,
neat.
And it said Beer of Olympians. So,
love it.
You know,
I buy it.
It had to be good. Yeah, so this brewery just seemed like such an adventurous take. So I told you about the smell. Let's try out the taste.
Yeah, lay some BJCP terms on me.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so I get a lot of the astringency from the wood barrel aging.
Mm-hmm. What other tasting notes are you getting?
God, it just tastes boozy. Tastes really
boozy.
It's got kind of aged beer and finish.
When you age beer in those other alcohol barrels, it gets really alcoholic.
It does. Well, especially because they were Pinot Noir barrels first.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, that definitely adds to the alcohol, the acidity. That's what I'm tasting on the back end is the acidity.
Interesting.
But it's 10.2% alcohol, so also
probably
not
just tastes hot,
surprise.
Too.
Yeah, it's definitely making me feel a little warm in the face. How do you feel, Ben? Ben's drinking it with me.
Now that you said warm in the face.
Now that you mentioned that, I'm dying.
I just wanted to have another drink.
Yeah. All right, Laura. What's you drinking?
Oh, hold on. I left the bottle in the kitchen.
Oh.
Sorry.
It's thick.
Yeah, It's got a really big body.
When you mention the barrels, it's like, well, then there you go.
There it
is. It's almost, it's like, you know, you describe wine as chewy. It's almost chewy. Ooh.
Almost, right? Mm.
Chewy.
Yeah. And so when they age in barrels, how much time in between that wine barrel to aging of the... You know what I'm saying?
Slutty beer in it,
because it would seem like it
you
would...
typically want fresh barrels, so you don't want dried out barrels.
Yeah.
So I know, at least from a local perspective,
feels very fresh.
Yeah.
Barely.
Yep. You get a lot of those
notes.
Yeah.
Mm. Yep.
All right. Ask me again.
Hey, Laura, what's your drink?
What you drink?
Okay, so today I have a Penfolds wine, of course, because you cannot talk about Australian wine without mentioning Penfolds. But sometimes our wines get a little rosy, so I'm drinking a very affordable one. Mm-hmm. The wine I have today is the Koonunga Hill Shiraz Cabernet Blend. If you remember from previous episode, Shiraz is also Syrah. It's just known as Shiraz in Australia.
We learned that.
And Penfolds is just a really renowned, not only in Australia, but worldwide. And it's one of the oldest wineries there, actually. And I like this wine because of the Koonunga. Like, as I've been researching to live there and researching this podcast episode, they just have, like, the wackiest names for things.
I know. I love it. I cannot wait to tell you about some hops later that are native to New Zealand and Australia. They have the best names.
I bet they
do. Well, New Zealand mostly, but yeah.
This wine specifically is from one of the Penfolds Barossa Valley Vineyards, which is one of the original sites where they're founded. I get some baking spices. It's pretty hot, too. I haven't let it sit open really long, so it's pretty alcohol-y. Red fruit. Not so much, like, leather or anything like that, which is sometimes you get out of Shiraz. So
like, bright.
Bright. It's pretty acidic. Yeah, I would say it is a bit acidic. But anywho, I chose that because that's where my first little segment in the episode is going to take us.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, now that I've let this beer warm up a little bit, you know, stouts are supposed to be drunk at a warmer temperature. To let the notes unfold. And I'm now starting to get some really, like, roasty, chocolatey notes.
Ooh, I bet.
Oh, probably helps that my palate's now used to the sort of the tartness and the acidity that came with the barrel aging.
Totally. And it's a far cry from what we were drinking last episode, so.
Absolutely. Well, Laura, you know, you'll be traveling all over the place, right? You're not like, tell us where we're going
to
go.
Yeah, totally. So we will all together go to pretty much the top 10 major cities in Australia. So I'm going to go into Melbourne. That'll be home base. I'm going to travel through Brisbane, Gold Coast, Hinterland Coast, which is on the like northeast side of the continent. Going to Adelaide, Sydney, which is down in the south, Perth. Which is on the opposite side.
Yeah,
they're doing their own thing over there. And in the end, I'll also have a chance to go to New Zealand as well, in Auckland, and possibly Christchurch.
Oh, man, that sounds amazing.
Oh,
so, like,
I'm so excited.
What's on your bucket list?
Totally. Okay, well, like I mentioned, the whole reason I chose this wine to start with is if you're going to talk Australian wine, you have to talk about Penfolds, world-renowned winery.
Because they're good or because they're just the best known?
Well, I mean... Both. I mean, they're definitely good. They're old to boot. They've been, like when we talked to Aaron Benson on one of the previous episodes, we talk about old world wine regions. Like, they're renowned, because of their reputation, but also because they have a lot of practice. And this winery's just been around for a long, long-ass time. So it's in South Australia, specifically in the Barossa Valley and also the Adelaide Hills area. They have a lot of different vineyard sites now that they've been around because they were founded in 1844.
Whoa.
Yeah, long, long time ago. And they were founded by Christopher Rawson Penfolds and his wife, Mary. And he was an English physician. He came on over, really, I guess, to, like, chase that frontier dream. I don't know.
Over from England?
Yeah. And just to give you a little bit of contextual background, if you're as woefully unfamiliar with Australian history as I was, in a two-minute or less history of Australia, it was founded in 1788. So when they came over to do this winery, it was almost 50 years later. So, you know, still relatively new.
Yeah, super new.
Super new. But Aboriginal Australians, the people have been there for, like, a long-ass time. Like 70,000 years.
Like the dawn of time.
Yeah. Like, yeah. So it's speculated that originally they were Southeast Asian maritime travelers and kind of washed up ashore there and settled. And Europeans didn't really bounce along hot on the scene, gosh, till like 1700. And a few dozen Dutch explorers came over, and they kind of called it New Holland, as you do as a explorer of that time when you find something.
You just call it the new wherever you're from.
Yep. It's a naming convention of the time. And there was some Indonesian fishers traveling around that time collecting sea cucumbers, which I thought was really interesting. And they're selling them to China, which is, I found that really interesting because that's still happening a lot in Tasmania. I watched an episode of Cooks Abroad, and their abalone, which is like this weird snail conch shell water thing.
Okay.
They're the largest source of it in the world, and the largest buyer is China. So China's just for centuries been buying up their weird sea life. I say weird. That's not correct. Their interesting sea life down
there.
Yeah. That's a long history and tradition of that. So anyways, and then it wasn't until around like 1770, James Cook came along. And as far as I can tell, it's like their Christopher Columbus.
Okay.
He was the guy who was like, I'm here.
Conquer this world.
Yeah, like this looks good. He chartered the whole eastern coast along where Sydney is and Brisbane, where we talked about. And he went back to England and was like, yeah, no, this is totally ripe for the colonization.
Yeah.
We got to tap into this. Got to tap that.
Yeah, and for some people who aren't familiar with Australian geography, Sydney is, as Sydney and Brisbane are on which coast?
On the east.
East
on
coast.
The east. And Brisbane is further north, and Sydney is a little bit further south. And actually, Sydney is where they, like, James Cook originally landed. But it wasn't called it back then. It was called Botany Bay, which is now called Sydney. But I want to take a left turn down this rabbit hole here.
Okay.
Because I got really excited as I was doing this research. You know that movie, the Quentin Tarantino movie, Hateful Eight?
I know of it.
You haven't seen it? Oh, my God. Okay.
You know I'm not a movie person. I said this last episode when we were talking about movie stars.
Oh, I know. But this is one of my, like, favorite Quentin Tarantino movies.
Okay.
It is a Western, and it's set, like, post-Civil War Colorado. Anywho, there's this badass character named Daisy Domergue, and spoiler alert across the board. She sings a song on the guitar while she's, like, poisoning everyone in the room with coffee. Cool. And I know.
Whoa, what a bad bitch.
She's so badass. But the song she's singing in, like, 1870 America. Okay, I'm going to try to sing you a little bit of it right now. Because you have to listen to the words. Okay.
Okay, I'm listening.
The storms are raging round us, all the winds are blowing gale. I'd rather drown in misery than gone to New South Wales. There's no time for mischief there, remember that, says they. They'll flog the poaching out of you down there in Botany Bay. So she's singing. Thank you, thank you.
Yeah, that was excellent.
So she was singing the song in America in the 1870s setting. But anyways, it's like about Australia and the convicts that they originally sent over there in 1778.
Oh, that's so funny.
It was like 1,000 people they sent, and 800 of them approximately were convicts.
Oh, so they were just like exporting crime?
Yeah, which is actually a pretty similar history to America. I read in White Trash, a 400-year untold history of social classes in America. I meant to look up the author's name. I'll put that on the website. But it was also the same thing. We were kind of colonized by getting the extra Scruff McGruff sent over. We'll just breed some soldiers. We'll pick you up when we're ready to colonize more stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's funny. Yeah, I feel like Australia and the United States have, like,
super similar.
Yeah, very relatable experiences in terms of, like, evolution, especially of the beer industry. And it sounds like regular history.
Yeah, I would absolutely buy that. But anywho, back to the Penfolds. Now that we have our scene set, what's happening there? they were a little further west near Adelaide. So if you go along the south coast into South Australia, which is one of the states there, the New South Wales is one of the states that the song mentions, where Sydney is, which is Botany Bay, used to be Botany Bay. You go down as Victoria, you keep going over to the left, it's South Australia. So Adelaide is in South Australia, and Barossa Valley, where Penfolds is one of the oldest wine regions in the continent. So I thought it was really interesting that they decided to settle here because when it was founded in 1842, it was mostly inhabited by and settled by Germans. And the wines that they grow there, as far as the Rhine, the Riesling, the Gewurztraminer, it's all very German.
Yeah. Well, Do you think it has anything to do with, like, the latitude and the climate? You know, last time we talked about how, you know, it's a great hop-growing region because it mimics the north, where a lot of the European hops are grown. I wonder if it's a similar climate.
So it's definitely interesting you say that, because the south part of the continent is absolutely more suited to wine growing, which makes sense about the hops, too, because it is cooler regions where those are grown typically. But it's still, I mean, it's still pretty warm, though, to be perfectly honest. You're still going to get pretty ripe grapes with pretty high sugar content. And when you have a lot of sugar, you know, when you ferment it,
it's a lot of booze.
Yeah, you get a lot of alcohol. So, but that really worked out for them, because that was really, like, what was in vogue at the time. People were drinking fortified wines and, you know, sherries and ports, and because they were on wooden ships and you're shipping barrels of wine. Yeah. And, you know.
I guess it's worth mentioning that, like, most of the – where Australia is inhabited is all along the coast.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
I found that very interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. And, I mean, it makes sense near the water, and things are easier to grow there. You get access to resources more quickly. So anyways, yeah, it was really in the time what was in style and what they had the means to make was really strong fortified wines, which is great because Christopher Penfolds was a physician. And he and his wife started making tonics for all of their patients.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And his practice grew and grew. And he was so busy being a doctor, his wife pretty much took over all the wine growing and wine making.
We won't call her a widow, but
so
maybe an emotional widow.
She was, until she was a real widow in 1870.
That's
tragedy
how it always ends.
I know. I was like, that's why I had to mention her, because that was such a theme.
I'm sensing a trend.
There really is a trend in badass wine and badass women being widows. So, yeah. She kicks ass, though. She takes it over, continues running the winery at almost 60 years old. And, you know, at the time, I'm sure her well-intentioned son-in-law said, hey, basically, I'm sure the conversation went like this. Sweet Mama Mary, you need to retire. This is not an appropriate job for you in your retirement years. Why don't you just have a seat and we'll sell this little winery for your retirement? And she said, listen, son, maybe fucking my daughter, but you're not going to fuck me out of my winery. She kicked ass. Like, 5 years after her husband died, this journalist came and was, he wrote his article about her. And I love this quote. The process of her mixing wine is done under Mrs. Penfold's personal supervision, not in conformity with any fixed wine, definite rule, but entirely according to her judgment and taste, which is, of course, how wine is made. But I love that she was getting credit for that in 1870. As being a
yeah, that's amazing. Good for her, making notoriety.
Hell yeah. But so she did eventually retire and pass on, and the winery has been wildly successful and run by the family until the 60s.
Oh, it is. Oh, till the 60s.
Well, then they were started. They went public in the 60s.
They went public. Is that like a common thing?
Stocks. I really don't know. I mean, I'm sure for companies, but they were pretty world renowned.
I mean, like,
at that
Bacardi
point.
Is a public company. And
yeah, I don't know about wineries. I feel like you've got to get a little big for that to work.
Yeah, that's wild.
So, you know, they produced those fortified wines until about the 50s, around the 60s, and then table wine was all the rage. People weren't maritime sailors anymore, so they didn't need
table tabs.
Yeah, fortified wine, which I don't know if we mentioned before, but fortified wine is regular wine mixed with distilled wine or distilled spirit. So it's basically like you mix a spirit into...
What spirit? Does it matter?
Well, typically it's done with brandy. So you, like, you have wine, you split it into two batches, you keep one normal, you distill the other, and then you mix them back together and
it... Yep. We learned about making brandy earlier this season.
We did. So, anywho, to bring it all back to the forefront, they do table wines now. They are really popular for a lot of their reds, and they make some really expensive wines. So they're most well-known for their wine called The Grange, which I would have loved to bring today, but it's around $700 to, like, $3,000 a bottle.
What? Why is it, how, the $700 to $3,000, that's, like a huge range.
Well, it depends on the year, the vintage, like, how great it was, how much there was.
Produce affordable wines also?
They have a lot of land, and they can make a lot of choices. So the, speaking of which, one of their smallest pieces of land from one of their, like, original vineyards, they sell, dude, they don't even sell this in, like, full bottles. They sell them in this word. Let me find it. Ampules.
Ampules?
Which is, like, a sealed, hermetically sealed glass specimen jar. And it's $168,000.
For what?
For this bottle.
Like
from Penfolds.
What?
And it is billed as the most expensive wine ever sold directly from a winery to the world.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
That's insane.
So from going to like to your son-in-law trying to talk you into selling your like life's passions to like being the most expensive wine in the world and the most renowned wine in Australia.
Whoa.
Like, come on. That's pretty cool. So that's on my bucket list to go there for sure.
Okay. Well, I hope you do. And I hope you get to try that wine without having to pay for it.
If I win the lottery, I'm getting this bottle.
Fly me out and I'm tasting it with you.
On like one of these wine websites I was on, I can't remember which one it was, they made the comment. They were like, oh, you could pay 4 experienced teachers for a year with that. I was like, oh.
Ooh, yeah. Ooh. The dark underbelly of the reality of how much we spend on booze.
Bah! Yeah.
Hooray, I'm so broke. Okay.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about Australia's beer history.
Yeah, please. What have you learned about it?
Well, the history and the craft movement sounds a lot like what happened in the United States, you know, granted, okay, on a little bit like more modest scale. You know, people were making and selling beer as early as colonizations were there. And obviously it was English styles that were popular, since that's who was colonizing.
Yeah.
And while the country never underwent like prohibition, there was a perfect storm of economic factors that essentially killed much of the brewing industry in the early 20th century. So,
oh, interesting.
It was like they had prohibition, but it just happened to be the times.
Was it just like a depression or what happened?
I mean, it was just a perfect storm of economic factors.
Yeah. All right.
Bye. Laura. Yeah.
Don't ask too many questions.
Yeah. I mean, it was like the price of ingredients meets like, you know,
renting sort space.
Of, yeah. Can't globalization, get your product mechanization. Like it was
the
just
perfect
a,
storm.
Yeah. I didn't write them down because I figured we weren't going to get that detailed.
Sorry, you know I'm a really detail-oriented
I know,
person.
I know, I told you to not to use so many numbers.
I know, I really thought I sheared it down.
No, you didn't. So, if we're doing a brief history...
which is hard, right? They've, like I ignorantly said in an early episode, they've been doing their thing for a long time over there, so...
Well, it's true. I mean, as long as they've been colonized, they've been making booze because that's where...
That's what you do.
Yeah, it was part of the culture from whence they came. But Australia kind of followed the U.S. movement in terms of the craft revitalization. And the country currently has about 400 breweries, thanks to a boom in recent years. Though, like the U.S., the market is dominated by the big guys. But just for some perspective, because I had to look at this, you know, I'm not familiar with the country. Last year, in 2017, there were 764 craft breweries in California.
Oh, wow.
So my thought was like, okay, so there are twice as many breweries in California as there are in Australia. Surely they're around the same size. Okay, that was speaking to my ignorance at the time. Australia is as big as the United States.
Crazy. Yeah.
The population of Australia is less than Texas at about 24, between 24 and 25 million. Wow. So in Oregon, which is a much smaller state, there were 266 breweries. So in all of Australia, there are about 400. I'm going to, like, from the Brewers, their version of the Brewers Association, 420, 430. I mean, to reel that back in a little bit, you know, Texas does not have 400 breweries. So technically, we have a long way to go.
Where are some of the breweries?
Yeah, so the Sail and Anchor Pub in Fremantle, which is in West Australia, which is near Perth. So that one is credited for jumpstarting the modern craft movement in the 1980s.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the pub is located in the historic Sail and Anchor Hotel, which is super cute building. It reminds me exactly of New Orleans. It's on a corner. It's got the second floor balconies with like the metal railing. It the brewery portion, or the iron rod fence, whatever. The brewery portion of it stopped producing in 2010, but the bar remains a hot spot for craft beer where you can find, you know, some of the local brews. And actually, they started producing beer again, but it wasn't on site. It was actually a contract brewing type of thing. Their beers are made by Feral Brewing Company, which it is cool, except they're also owned by like a Coca-Cola branch.
Oh.
So they have the same type of...
macro brewing or whatever.
Yeah, the same type of consolidation that we're experiencing in the United States.
That makes sense. It's not personal, it's business. Yeah. Oh, that was the last episode.
It's not personal. Definitely. You know, I put out a call in a Facebook group for Texans asking, you know, like, what are the can't miss pubs in Australia? So I have a whole other list that I'm going to give to you. I'll post it on our website as well.
Oh, I'm excited to see that. I'll do a walking tour through them. Maybe not a walking. It's really spread out there. I'll do a tour, a drinking tour through them all.
Yeah. All right.
Well, I definitely would love to tell you about some wine and distilleries I found as well. But let's take a quick break and wet our whistle. And then we'll come back and talk all things Aussie.
Hey, y'all. Thanks for listening to Grapes and Grain Podcast.
If you are a retailer or a producer and would like to sponsor us or have your product featured in our What You Drinkin' segment, drop us an email at grapesingrain@gmail.com. That's grapes, the letter N, grain, at gmail.com.
Cheers! You know, Laura, I can't believe how much fun creating this podcast with you has been.
I know. It's been a blast, and we've learned so much. But no matter what we release, I always feel like there's more to share.
Golly, if only there was a way to share all our bonus material with all of our listeners.
Actually, Teenie, there is. If our listeners support us on patreon.com/grapesandgrain, they'll gain access to all kinds of bonus materials, plus they'll be helping us produce more quality episodes of Grapes and Grain.
Wow, exactly how does that work?
Fans of the podcast can go to patreon.com/grapesandgrain to make a monthly or one-time contribution to the podcast. Those contributions make it possible for us to create the quality segments we all know and love.
What you drinking?
And our fans that pledge to make a monthly contribution will get access to fun extras and bonus materials not released to the public.
Dude, that is so cool and so easy. What's that website again?
It's patreon.com/grapesandgrain. Log on and make a contribution today.
I do not want one, but you guys can have one. I'm going to go on the record as saying I do not want a shot.
Ben, where's your glass at?
Raise your glass.
All right, y'all. Welcome back from the commercial break. We may or may not be doing shots, but they're not Australian, so we're not going to talk about them.
Yeah. They're remnants of our celebrity post. Oh, yeah. A little goes a long way. Dabble, do ya? You're going to have some heart episodes.
Oh, all my gosh. Same, dude. Why do they put this lime salt in a bottle that can pour out so easily?
Oh, I think you're supposed to peel this off and then use the lid.
What lid?
The lid with the holes in it, like a shaker.
Well, that information would have been very helpful earlier.
Yeah, thanks, Laura, for sharing your insight. Now I just have this giant hand of salt.
Now I just have this handful of salt.
Sometimes you just have a handful of salt.
God, isn't that the truth? I'm going to enjoy some salt with you guys, even though I'm not enjoying the tequila.
I didn't say I was enjoying this tequila.
So, Australia. So, before the break, you were telling me a little bit about some crowdsourcing you did about the best breweries and bars to visit.
I did, yeah. I put a call out. There are several, way too many Facebook groups devoted to the love of beer, and I happened to be in all of them. So I put a call out on one of them and got some really great feedback. I will tell you about some of the breweries, but I'm really curious about some of the wineries out there.
Yeah, okay. How about this? I'll tell you about some wineries, you tell me about some breweries, and I'll give you a little extra with some distilleries.
That sounds good.
Okay. I only have two wineries to mention. There's a lot of great ones, so it was really hard to pare that down outside of Penfolds. So one of the other ones I'm really excited about visiting is in Heathcote, Victoria. So it's a Burke and Willis winery. And Burke and Willis are like their Lewis and Clark. Famous explorers.
That's amazing.
So it's really wild and adventuresome like brand. But the reason I chose them is the owner and operator, Andrew Patterson, is also a music promoter and producer.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah.
So he's like Australia's Live Nation?
Kind of. I don't know if he's like that monopolizingly big. But when he's not overseeing producing these shows, he's producing some amazing top-notch wines. So Victoria's are arguably one of the home, like, the best Shiraz in Australia.
That's awesome, because geographically speaking, I'm sorry we have to mention geography so much in this episode, but
I didn't really know it before I started
looking
this up. Yeah,
unless you've been to that side of the world, Victoria's south, correct?
Yes. I'm actually pulling up right now because I don't want to mess this up, but I'm pretty sure it's the most southeastern tip.
Yeah, Ben's got a map.
Oh, do you? Oh, yes.
Jack and Dorothy Studios, they have the world map on the wall.
Aw.
the globe.
The globe on the wall. That's so magical. So, yes, it is, which is a really great, like we mentioned earlier, climate and region for that. But Birkin Wells, Shiraz has won a multitude of awards, including Best Young Shiraz, Best Single Vineyard Shiraz, Best Heathcote Produced Wine, and the Tone O'Leary St. Martin Trophy for Best Shiraz. But they're not only doing that. They have some other notables. Chardonnay became really popular in the 80s to grow there, some Cabernet blends. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned in the Syrah episode earlier, originally this grape was used just for blending.
Yep.
So
wasn't given its own sort of spotlight.
Yeah, it's like time in the sun till, you know, didn't break out on its own till a little later. But one of their most popular wines is called Mr. Burke's Favorite Big Red. And Mr. Burke is their Clydesdale on property. And it helps. Named after Burke and, you know, named after the explorer. But they have this Clydesdale out there, and it helps with the pruning and harvesting. That's and so sweet. He snacks on some of the grapes when they're harvesting.
Oh, my gosh. So, I want to meet Mr. Burke.
Mr. Burke. So not only do I want to go have some of this amazing wine, but I want to check out this Clydesdale, too. So the other winery that I had pulled up to mention is also a really old winery, too, like Penfolds is. It's 150-year-old winery, and it's in Hunter Valley in New South Wales, where we mentioned earlier.
Near Don't Botany. Go there.
Yeah. near Botany Bay, which is now Sydney. And Hunter Valley is just to the west of that, and it is the oldest wine region in Australia. Wow. Because that's where, you know, people were coming in and bringing clippings and planting them down. Yeah. And so 100 years ago, this was an award-winning winery. They were winning awards for their claret and their fortified wine, which I mentioned the fortified wine earlier is beefed up wine. And the claret is what I drank last episode. It's a like Bordeaux style blend, really only of English descent. People call it claret, which makes sense because there's one out there in New South Wales. Mm-hmm. So, but they continue to be a front runner in local and international competitions with their Semillon and Shiraz, which you've had a Semillon wine with me before. Uh-huh. At 60 Vines. You remember that Sauternes sweet white dessert wine?
Oh, yeah. How can one forget that?
I know. I was going to say, I feel
you
like
were looking
one
at me and I was like, how am I going to remember this one wine? But that's because it was super distinct and not 100% enjoyable.
Yeah, that's why I knew you would remember it, because it left an impression on you for sure. But so in front, so the Semillon grape is really susceptible to botrytis, which is the mold that makes it all like that. Okay. But that happens in Sauternes, mostly in France, where it's made into a dessert wine. Okay. But you can also have it as like a table wine as well.
Ooh, I would not, but thanks
it's
for the
not
option.
As, yeah, it's not as that. It's not as intense as all that. Anyway, so the Agnew family acquired the vineyard and the winery in 2004, and they're continuing this legacy of excellence. And they've brought home already 30 gold awards in various international competitions since they owned it.
Yeah. Sounds like there's a lot of prestige in the old wine.
Yes.
Culture there.
Yes.
Is there a lot happening in new wine culture, or is it mostly still legacy brands and products?
I mean, there are definitely some new things happening, following trends, people, you know, branching out and doing experimental stuff. But I'll touch on this a little later when we talk about varietals there. But old wines are big there. Old vines, and they did a really good job of protecting and keeping some. They have some of the oldest vines in the world. So
awesome.
That's why they're well known for that.
Interesting.
What breweries did you find while you're, maybe not even breweries, just pubs to go check out?
Yeah, well, I've got a couple of breweries first for you. I mentioned Sail and Anchor earlier, which I would love to go to. It's strictly a pub now. But there are a couple of breweries that sort of stuck out in my research. The first one's going to be Pirate Life Brewing.
I love all of these names so far. They're so swarthy.
I know, they are.
Swashbuckling.
The Australian are great at branding. So this is in Hindmarsh, which is an inner suburb of Adelaide, so sort of like the Lakewood to Dallas type of thing.
Gotcha.
It was voted number one by Australians in a craft brewery survey. That was before it was picked up into AB InBev's Anheuser-Busch InBev's portfolio. Ooh, gotcha. So that happened at the end of 2017.
So that happened.
But they're really notable. People in the States actually probably know about them too, because they did a collaboration with Ballast Point Brewing Company out of San Diego.
Love Ballast Point.
Yeah, and its highest ranked beers on Rate Beer, which is a beer rating website, are a stout and a mosaic IPA. So those are two styles that I would encourage you to have a Fleo try while you guys are out there.
Yeah, Absolutely.
The next one I got to mention is called Stone and Wood Brewing Company. This is in an entirely different part of the country. It's in New South Wales, which is about 2 hours from Brisbane, which is complete opposite side of the country. It was named a can't miss brewery in this book I have called Best Beer by Stephen Beaumont and Tim Webb. You know, I got Facebook recommendations to go there. And in that craft beer survey that I mentioned earlier, it was rated number 4. So
wow,
they have some really sessionable year-round beers and then also some hoppy beers, pale ale, pils. What I found interesting when I was looking up all these Australian breweries is all of their beers are for sale by the case online.
Oh,
like
interesting.
You can order a case offline. Granted, it'll cost you about $75.
Ooh.
Yeah, not cheap, but I like having the option.
I like the option.
So the last brewery I have to mention is called Little Creatures. And
I like that name too.
I know. Isn't that great? So it actually has 2 breweries, one out west in Fremantle, Western Australia, and then one in, gosh, I'm going to butcher this, Geelong. Have you heard of this place in Victoria?
Let me see the spelling. Gosh, it could be Geelong or Geelong. I wouldn't put anything past these.
Geelong, Geelong. Those breweries about 37 hours apart. Ooh. So if you were to take a car, that's how long it would take you to get from one to the other. Now, this brewery was started by the same group of dudes who started brewing at Sail and Anchor Pub that I mentioned earlier.
Mm.
So they're credited with starting the modern craft movement.
Yeah.
After Sail and Anchor, they had another brewery in between called Matilda Bay. But Little Creatures was kind of their comeback for the modern movement, and they are known for their American pale ale. It's said to be iconic.
Ooh, okay.
So this is like the iconic Australian pale ale, except it's American style, so that's how they got known. Like I said, the Australian beer movement, reflects a lot of the American craft beer movement, because I think they were taking cues from across the world.
Yeah.
So when you go to Australia, besides Shiraz and Shiraz.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it'd go either way. It just depends on your accent.
I know. One day I'm going to get it.
Yeah.
Are there any other specific styles of Australian wine you're excited to drink?
Well, before I go too deep into other wines, I do want to just give a nod to 2 distilleries that I know we are mostly beer and wine, but these really caught my eye and I really want to try them. And I'm going to try to, I don't know how much shipping will be, but I already know I want to ship a couple of these bottles back to you.
Can you put them in your suitcase?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess I could. Yeah. You just have to wait 7 months for them.
You're right. Send them.
The first one is Distillery Botanica, and that's on the Central Coast in New South Wales. It's a boutique distillery, and it's owned by Philip Moore, who is a trained herbalist and horticulturist and turned gin distiller.
I knew that's where that was going. Yeah.
And you know, one of our favorite words to describe drinks is herbaceous. So that's what this place is all about. The distillery lives on 3 acres of beautifully manicured gardens that have been there for a half century. And that's where a lot of the botanicals that are used in the gin to flavor the gin are grown.
Nice.
As well. And they've won a ton of awards, and they pride themselves in their lineup of dry gins, botanical gins, vodkas, and all of their liquors are no artificial flavors ever.
I love that.
Why do we put
artificial flavoring in booze
That whole conversation about like cognac and that just blew my mind. I mean, I guess because you can't mass produce a consistent high quality and meet demand.
Because if there's anything we learn from Robert Licorice is that there are so many different factors that go into flavor.
So many. And then the other distillery I'm really jazzed to try is in Tasmania, actually, which is like a freestanding island off the south coast, but still a state of Australia. And it's Lark Distillery. So they are the pioneer of the whiskey scene from the early 90s. Yes, I knew you would. That's why I had to include it. So the founder, Bill Lark, decided to open the distillery in Coal River Valley after visiting Scotland. And he noticed a striking similarity in the climate, which you've mentioned a couple times, I was so excited to go here.
Marshy.
In the podcast, also physically go here. And the multitude of peat bogs and barley producers that were also in Tasmania as well, and the amazing quality of natural spring water. So, you know, he was sitting out on the patio one day with his family, and they said, let's do it. And they did. They were pioneers. And
they were doers, not sayers.
They were. And it was a family affair as well when they brought his daughter on, Christy, as the lead distiller. She was one of the world's youngest female distillers at the time. I know.
Girl power.
Yeah. And they've won a ton of awards, too. Everyone we're talking about here today on the podcast has just won, you know, a multitude. But so to get back into your previous question.
Sorry to jump ahead. I just got so excited.
No, that's totally cool. I would have gone with the flow, except for I really wanted to highlight those distilleries. I was excited about those. I am excited to drink some of the other wines there as well. I do want to just, you know, acknowledge Australia's, they're a pretty sparsely populated place, but they're still the fourth largest exporter of wine in the world. And a lot of that is to Asia, just like a lot of their produce and food.
Yeah, a lot of their other products. That's
mm-hmm. They have a ton of designated wine regions. And their predominant grape is the Syrah or Shiraz. They also do Cabernet Sauvignon and Chardonnay. I feel like after the 80s, everyone's growing Cab Sauv and Chardonnay. You got it.
That's what the people want. Give the people what they want.
And Semillon and Pinot Noir Rieslings, and in the 70s, especially, like the Gewurztraminer Rhine wines and Rieslings were really popular from there as well. After they got off of fortified wines, it kind of got into sweet wines and then into table reds, and that's really where their market is now.
Cool. What an evolution.
I know. I thought it was really interesting, too. But to bring it back to the comment you made earlier asking about the old wines, so, yeah, that is kind of like how they made a name for themselves, and especially in Brosa Valley after they fortified wines kind of went out of vogue, that's how they got their name back. Mm-hmm. So if you remember Phylloxera, I mentioned it almost every episode.
Yep.
Devastating for the wine world. T.V. Munson.
I know. I almost feel like Phylloxera needs its own like sound effects. Like, dun-dun-dun. Dun-dun-dun. Phylloxera.
That's devastating the world around the same time that they're really just up and coming. But through some pretty crafty and clever and strict quarantine laws and immigration laws, they were able to really isolate quite a few regions where its phylloxera has never been detected, as South Australia, Western Australia, the Northern Territory, and Tasmania itself, too.
Wow, that seems like quite a bit.
I thought that was pretty remarkable. And
considering, 90% of the country doesn't even have humans in it.
You know, good on them.
90% is not a verified fact. That is, that is sensationalization.
So they do have a lot of old vines because they weren't ravished by this phylloxera.
Cool.
But there was a time once fortified wines kind of fell out of style and, you know, they weren't using Syrah as blending wines anymore. And they ripped them all up to throw in these Chardonnay vines because everyone was growing Chardonnay. And because they just couldn't sell the Syrah. There was Shiraz. They just couldn't get rid of it, give it away, even as a blending wine. So a lot of those are torn up. But then in the late 80s, there was an emergence of like several of these boutique family owned wineries. Mm-hmm. And then boom, all of a sudden they have like the old vines, and which is kind of a term that's thrown around on labels a lot that doesn't really have like a designated meaning.
How do these people in the 80s have old vines? Like, is it the actual plants or is that a euphemism?
Like the Syrah vines themselves are like 100-150 years old and they've been in the ground and they're huge and gnarly and like tree-like and just craggy and crazy, and they're producing these really intensely flavored wines because they're out of their like young buck youth. And so anyways, that's what put them back on the map. So yeah, that's a big part of what's happening there. So I'm absolutely excited to try that. But yeah, I am excited too about their German heritage, like sweet white wines. And I feel like it's more of a sentimental thing.
Really? Why?
So in the 70s, I mentioned Gewurztraminers, Rieslings, and Rhine wines. And my grandma, or my Nana, she loves Rhine wine. Still to this day, she's like, oh, are you going to the store? See if they have any Rhine. Like, it's not the 70. I don't know how to find that, you know?
Yeah, I don't either. I don't think I've ever seen that specified on a wine aisle.
I mean, it's in the jug aisle, for sure, if it's anywhere.
I like your Nana already.
But the reason this got worldwide popularity, there was a winemaker from Angoves? We're having a hard problem with our hard and soft Gs.
Yeah. So we did not nail it today.
No nail. Thomas Angove. He's a winemaker in South Australia, but he invented the bag in the box.
What?
The bag in the box wine. That is an Australian invention.
Oh my God, I should have known.
Right?
should have known.
So that's why a lot of these wines were able to travel so far and become more accessible to people like my grandma, who weren't, you know, fancy wine drinkers or anything like that.
Yeah.
And I love this because Bag in a Box, and specifically these like sweet German wines, are my very first memory of wine ever in life. My grandma handed me a glass and saying, hey, will you go fill this up from the box in the fridge, throw a couple ice cubes in it.
Go visit Auntie Fran in the fridge.
And speaking of fancy wine things, screw top bottles. Australia didn't invent screw top bottles. A French company, ooh, let's see if I can nail this one, named Les Bouchages Mécaniques.
I'm going to give that one to you.
All right. But they did invent it at the request of an Australian production director for Yalumba named Peter Walls. And that was in the late 60s, early 70s. And they are really, you know, Ben and I were talking about it before the episode started. Like, is it fancy? Is it not? Is it connotation? Is it, you know, they're great. They work for keeping the wine fresh. If you're going to lay it down for 30 years, it doesn't oxidize the way you might mm-hmm. want a cork to. But really, Australia and New Zealand are the two biggest users in the world of these screw top bottles. So that's anyways, cool. I thought that was fancy. And I just wanted to throw that in there.
Did they invent slapping the bag?
I would not be shocked. I would love to know the origin of slapping a bag. I didn't get it when I was doing it. I don't get it now.
What is slapping the bag?
You just take the bag of wine out of the box and then you slap it. Socially group drink. And before some drunk sorority sister or frat boy holds the bag in the air and says, slap the bag. And then you slap it and then you guzzle out of the nozzle.
Yeah, you twist it and it makes it, quote unquote, it makes it go faster. But I think it's probably just fun.
Scientifically accurate.
Well,
maybe. I don't know. I feel like I don't it goes think fast it enough on its own.
Yeah, I don't think it's scientifically, but that's the idea.
Yeah.
Slap of the bag.
Rich in tradition.
Oh, it is rich in tradition.
That's our next, not our next, but one of our next podcast episodes. Let's research the cheapest beer and wine ever, and let's trace the history of slapping the bag.
Yeah. But what about beer? Are there any, you know, obviously Shiraz is the main player here with wine, but like what's the most notable style in beer?
This is a great question because there is many answers. So there are many answers.
Lay them on me.
Yeah, so great question. A couple of answers for you. One style of beer that is truly original to Australia is called the sparkling ale.
Ooh.
And Cooper's that I mentioned earlier, who's iconic, sort of credited with reviving the style. Mm. And according to the book Best Beers that I mentioned earlier, it's really seeing a renaissance. But the dominant style, the most popular style, is the pale ale, which is convenient because it's in a pretty dope part of the world to grow hops.
I love farming and hops in beautiful places. Tell me more about that.
I know we've mentioned this before, but I kind of wanted to give you a sense of what you might be able to see in terms of like the agricultural aspect of hops.
Because I'll kind of be there through like spring. So hopefully I can visit some of these farms. Tell me about them.
Yeah. So I found about a dozen hop varieties that are grown in Australia, and some of their signatures include the Galaxy hop, which is predominantly a flavor hop, an alpha acid, and then also the Helga hop, which is mostly used for aroma. And Victoria area and Tasmania have the best climates for growing hops.
Totally makes sense, like the two most southerly things.
Yeah, correct. And so I wanted to point you in the direction of one hop farm.
Okay.
Actually, I dove so far into researching this hop farm that I really didn't have time to look up any others, but you're going to love this.
Okay.
It's called Bushy Park, and it was founded
I already love it.
It's called Bushy Park in the bush. It was founded in 1864, and in 2018 had its 153rd hop harvest.
Wow.
So this is on South Tasmania. So they are known for a hop I mentioned earlier called Helga.
Mm.
So the can't miss thing here is what they call the text kiln. It's an oast house, which is like the old school kiln for drying hops. The guy who owned it, Mr. Ebenezer Shoebridge.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Scrooge.
Nope. Shoebridge. He was super religious.
How could you not be with a name like that?
I know, right? So he owned this hop farm with his wife and eight kids.
Oh, also fits the bill.
Yeah, and they call it a text kiln because on the inside he put these words, and I will read them to you.
Was it a pep talk to the hops?
Or no, I think it was more like a religious devotion.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so some of the quotes I found, it's like, and these words that I mean, they're straight out of the Bible. You're going to know this. And these words that I command thee this day shall be in thine heart, and thy shall write them on the posts of thine house and on thine gate. And then in the middle of this building, he had, you know, this sign that said, God is love. It was before, like, rhinestone cowboy signs were kind of a thing. And on the other far side of his house, he, you know, had the words, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son that forever believeth in him should who's ever. Obviously, I haven't read the Bible very much. Whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. So
John 3:16, the word of the God, Lord, thanks be to God.
Yeah. So
and with you.
I thought that you would like that.
Really neat. That's interesting, though. He was an alcohol maker and like inscribe it. Maybe that's how he like. He's like, it's cool. I'm making booze. I wrote Bible quotes on all my equipment.
Maybe, but I mean, you and I have talked about how like booze and religion are pretty much really inseparable, yeah, except for in the United States when booze was considered the devil, and that's what brought prohibition on.
Oh my gosh. I just actually watched, we should do a whole episode about this, but I actually watched the Ken Burns documentary on prohibition recently, and it was very fired up by like religion and people, yeah, just men not living up to their duties.
Fullest potential, yeah. So that, the Bushy Park with the text kiln, that's on the edge of the Derwent Valley, okay, which is apparently the go-to region for hop growing.
I'm so excited to check that out.
I know, I cannot wait. So that's in Tasmania.
Awesome. Well, what about New Zealand? Was there any hop growing over there, did you find?
Absolutely. And, you know, New Zealand has been coming into its own as far as a beer scene.
Wine, too.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, predominantly the beer scene growth is powered and driven by the hops that they grow there. Mm. And I told you I had some fun hop names for you.
Yes.
But I have another fun fact for you.
Ooh.
The executive director of the New Zealand Brewers Guild is a woman. Her name is Sabrina Kuntz. Shout out to Sabrina.
Hey, Sabrina. Do your thing, girl.
Yeah, believe in what you're doing. Represent the ladies well. So in New Zealand, there are more than 75 breweries.
Wow.
And the hot spots to me seem to be Auckland and Canterbury.
Yeah,
as far as the beer scene goes, if you're going to check out, you know, Auckland's beer scene, I recommend Epic Beer.
Okay.
They also sell cases, and when I went to their website, they were like, have a squiz at our beer, which means have, like, a look.
Oh.
Have a squiz.
A squiz.
Yeah.
Oh, I love so other English lingo.
So take that with you.
Yeah. It's like crack in Ireland.
Yeah, but
have a squiz and a crack.
Yeah.
Some crack. Oh, that's so funny.
So, New Zealand, they have more than 20 hop varieties. And I looked at a list and I had not heard of most of them. Some of my favorite names were Riwaka and Wataku. And they are both aroma hops. They're known for their citrusy characteristics. That that just seems like a never-ending well of fun hoppy experiences.
You could totally go down. Do you think a lot of these interesting names are related to the native languages?
Oh, they absolutely are.
Absolutely.
They absolutely are. Like I said, Moa was named for the...
Yeah, they're Maori there, right? Is that correct? Or is that... Am I making that up?
I wish I knew.
Yeah, I feel like I saw a independent film about whale and a girl. That's the only... I'm pulling that out of my memory.
From everything that I read about New Zealand's beer scene, it resonated that they're, like, super, like... into their cultural heritage.
I love that.
Mm-hmm.
Good for
and
them.
I just spoke to one of our friends who just went to New Zealand. She said she spent like a month there, and she was saying, you know, anything you need to import is really expensive, but the things they do well are coffee and beer and wine.
Oh, set.
I know. I'm like, so why done. Do you need to go anywhere? She's like, a cup of, you know, whatever from across seas will run you like $6, but if you get a cup of New Zealand coffee, it'll cost you like $2.50.
Perfect. Like, yes. Well, I'll definitely be visiting New Zealand towards the end of the year, so I'll be sure to check out some of those things. I do want to give a nod to their wine scene as well. You know, in 2017, it's recorded that I want to say they have like about 90,000 acres, and 75% of that is Sauvignon Blanc. Like, that's what they do.
Well, you're the person who turned me on to – I didn't consider myself a white wine drinker until you turned me on to – Sauvignon Blancs from New Zealand.
Yeah, that was one of the very first wines that when I delved into this tasting notes, keeping a journal, doing things side by side, tasting comparisons. That was, I think, the first dinner we all did together. I brought over a few different Sauvignon Blancs. So, yeah, the Marlboro region specifically is really well known for their Sauv Blancs. And
that's where Moa is based.
Oh, well. So in California, Sauvignon Blancs are, they have a fruitier quality. There's more citrus notes with, like, lemon and grapefruit. But in New Zealand, their Sauvignon Blancs are typically more green and herby and grassy. And, yeah, they kind of came onto the scene pretty recently in around the mid-80s. There's a wine writer named George Tabor that wrote about Cloudy Bay's Sauvignon Blanc says what many people considered to be the world's best Sauvignon Blanc. So that's, you know, around the time in California and Australia. So when new world wines are coming hot on the scenes and really having a showdown with a lot of European wines in these blind tastings.
Yeah, that's cool because it sounds like Australia comes from, like, the old culture of wine, the old vineyards, and it sounds like New Zealand's maybe, like, the newer wave of production.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's got a long and sordid history and a lot of nuances for sure. I really can't wait to get in there and immerse myself in it and send back some interviews and recordings along the way. And hopefully we can record an episode there when you come and visit me.
Yeah, I'll raise a glass of that.
Well, cheers, girl. Thanks for the bucket list.
Yeah. Oh, I forgot that I put the lime salt in the bottom of that beer. Oh, you guys. Well, thank you so much for joining us on Grapes and Grain Podcast. You can check us out on our website and our social media. We've got on Instagram, we're Grapes and Grain Podcast, _ in between each word.
Mm-hmm.
Send us your reader mail.
What else? Yeah, send us your reader mail. That email address is grapesingrain@gmail.com. The letter N.
All right, y'all. Till next time.
Thanks so much.
Stay tipsy.
Stay tipsy, my friends.
Stay tipsy, my friends.
Thanks for listening to Grapes and Grain Podcast. If you'd like to be featured in our future listener mail segment, please email any questions, comments, or anecdotes to grapesandgrain@gmail.com. That's grapes, the letter N, grain@gmail.com.
Absolutely. We love to hear from listeners and share fun stories and answer any random questions we get. You can also follow us on Instagram and Facebook. Find us on Instagram at grapesandgrainpodcasts, _ between each word, and just search for Grapes and Grain Podcasts on Facebook.
Remember, that's grapes, plural, grain, singular. You can also find us online at grapesandgrainpodcast.wordpress.com to see blog posts that go more in-depth to each episode. You can also download or stream our podcast there and find lots of other content about beer and wine.
And of course, find us on patreon.com/grapesandgrain if you'd like to pledge a monthly contribution. Thanks so much for listening to our podcast today.
Cheers!
What you drinking?